Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life.
And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lau.
So we got an email the other day from Mead, a guy trying to join up in our forums. Yeah, he has a lot of nice things to say. He said he liked the Apocalypse episode and both of them, and about the elves. He was really interested in the idea of the elves losing the will to live and how that might bring along the elven apocalypse. It actually got me thinking of a lot of stuff, too. It was pretty cool. And he recommended a system called Pendragon, which I'd only heard of by name before. And looking it up on Wikipedia, it looks really, really cool.
Yeah, I've actually been looking for the core book for a long time now. There's a gaming store in Shinjuku, which is in Tokyo. That's near where I go to class, and it has, I think, the Viking or the Saxons supplement, but it doesn't actually have the core book for Pendragon, or the most recent printing of it or release edition. Yeah, it looks awesome.
Yeah, I mean, it's got a really cool, like a virtue and vice kind of system going to it, and all these different moods and persuasions that help how your character goes. And you can, like, do a lineage, apparently, where you play the heirs of your characters and going down a family line or a house. Yeah, it sounds awesome.
I've heard that Song of Ice and Fire role-playing is a good stand-in for Pendragon if you wanted to run a Pendragon-style game.
Mm-hmm. I could see that.
Yeah, it sounds a lot very similar to it. But actually, White Wolf bought the property from Chaosium, so I wonder if that's where they got their Virtue and Vice ideas from.
I don't know, but I guess you don't really need to buy the property to steal the ideas.
Obviously, but yeah. Oh, I don't know.
Yeah. What is it? Can't copyright mechanics?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also just from a design standpoint, there's almost nothing that hasn't already been done, and all you can do is look at it in a new and different way.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Combine it in that nice combination. Mm. So it works together.
Or just slap it onto something new.
Right.
Kind of hope it works.
After the Apocalypse episode, when we were talking about the elves, I was on Amazon, and I noticed that they're advertising this game called Lost Days of Memories and Madness, and it was on for a pretty reasonable price. And actually, Amazon KoJP was selling it as well. So I ordered that. And it's certainly a different... It's a storytelling game of intrigue and insanity at the end of the world. So that's pretty fitting. And it's about elves.
And memories and madness.
They can't elves. Steal ideas, damn it.
Elves wasn't in the title.
All right.
But it does get into like what we were talking about in the Apocalypse episode. And it's certainly an interesting mechanic. I'm not sure, we haven't played the game yet, but I'm not sure how like a game would run, but certainly the conflicts and like a one-shot session is pretty cool. And it's like knockout, which is interesting.
Hmm.
Is that players are essentially knocked out of the game, and then they join like kind of the adversarial role, and it's last person standing, which is very unusual for a role-playing game. So I guess it is not unique, but certainly different than what the other games that are out there. It's very thin.
Yeah, it is kind of different from, I guess, what would be called or considered a traditional role-playing game, in that you have no stats, you have no character sheet, really. Just your character consists of your name and four memories that are not necessarily your own.
Hmm.
And it's a GM-less game as well, so everybody plays a character.
Is it a role-playing game or a storytelling game?
Storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
Each player starts with a set number of memories. And that's the big currency for the elves, is memories. And they take them from other people. And part of the game is to take memories from other people or use memories. So
yeah, that's how you get knocked out. You end up with no memories and you go insane. You get knocked out and have to fill the adversarial role.
Interesting.
This opens chapter one. I thought it was pretty cool. I remember falling from atop a spire. I remember the king of the elves dead at my feet. I remember drawing the sword of twilight and watching us all who loved me turn to jealous rivals. I remember betraying my mother, taking the last of her memories as she lay dying. I remember enchanting the forbidden ritual which opened the door beneath the palace. I remember the orcs at the gate as far as the eye could see. I remember the fall of the elves one by one until only I remained. Yeah, I thought that really captures the spirit of the game.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of memories and a lot of madness, yeah. Yeah, so that's definitely worth checking out, even if you were just going to mine it for other ideas, but it would certainly be interesting to play. And I think it goes for under $15.
Oh, that's very nice then.
Yeah, and although it is quite a very small book, the ideas are different enough that you certainly don't feel like you've... Well, you certainly get your money's worth, in my opinion.
I think it actually came from one of the Game Chef design contests, which is like an annual contest where the participants are given four elements and either a very short amount of time, either 24 or 48 hours, to craft a role-playing game that incorporates those four things.
Yeah, it's from Game Chef 2007, and the four ingredients were currency, drug, memory, and palace. Anyway, that's definitely worth checking out, especially if I was going to recommend a storytelling game, yeah, this would be the one.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. That looks really interesting. Yeah. One of the other interesting things we got from DriveThruRPG that made me think of an old game was we got these really cool paper craft spaceships from Desktop War Games, and they're really, I think, really cool. It made me want to bust out Battlefleet Gothic, because you could totally use those paper craft ships. Like, they're system neutral. All they are is sort of the ship models.
Yeah. So
that would be a really reasonable alternative to buying all the Games Workshop models to play Battlefleet Gothic. So they're constructed modularly, which means you can basically assemble them however you want.
Mm-hmm.
So you can get a lot of different variety out of, like, a single pack of ships.
Yeah.
So I'm going to check those out and give them a try.
Oh, that's good.
Cool. Yeah. That sounds awesome.
Yeah.
We went out drinking and for dinner with some of my classmates after the exam.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy's like, check out that table over there. And I said, are they checking us out? And he's like, no. And I said, well, I don't care. It's like, dude, it's got to be a little something, little spark.
Yeah, but maybe you could have started that spark that had you checking them out.
I was sitting there.
And that's enough. I walk in a room and everyone should be looking at me.
But should I make a loud noise and they look over? What?
Did somebody turn a light on? Oh no, Lyle came in.
Did I tell you I went to the, I had my physical on Tuesday, my annual physical. And, I have the body of a man 4 years younger. And, the doctor described me as muscular. So.
So what he's indirectly saying is he's close to getting people to notice him, like that actor who plays Al Seed on True Blood.
Yeah.
You're getting there.
My doctor uses charts for Japanese people, so he says, well, by the numbers, you're morbidly obese, but you don't look that fat. Gee, thanks, Doc.
Yeah. Now, I posted that on on Facebook, and I hoping to get people to, you know, like, joke around. And then a bunch of people just liked it, so then I ended up just looking really vain. Well, a couple people joked along with it, so I could joke back, but then...
Which is what you were going for.
Other people were like, yeah, good job, you know, yeah, congratulations. You're like, yeah. It's kind of not going for that. Because 4 years younger for me is still old.
What is it, like 92?
You've got the body of an 80-year-old. Congratulations.
Well, yeah. Speaking of sort of polling people and getting a lot of likes.
Oh, that was awkward.
That was all a right. Weak connection.
You got a better one? You got a better one then?
No.
The new D&D Next articles since the last episode came out. And
oh, speaking of 4 years younger.
Okay.
You could do that.
Speaking of geriatric.
Speaking of four editions younger, the new D&D Next is...
All right. Where was I again?
The new D&D Next article.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So one of them was from Mike Merles, just saying the areas of focus that the next playtest packet was going to address. Rumor is we should see the next playtest packet somewhere around Gen Con, which is going to be in the next week or two. So we kind of talked about the fighter last episode. That's what they're going to look at. They're also looking at critical hits, which they're not going to address. And the thing that really stuck out to me, though, was the way they're going to address skills. They said they're coming out with a set list that will help them build backgrounds and help you build your own kind of backgrounds. But apparently one of the complaints they got was that people felt it was ridiculous for the cleric to have a better chance of detecting traps than the rogue. And to fix that, Wizards is toying around with giving the rogue a choice between using an ability score modifier or just a flat +3 bonus in addition to the skill bonus when using a skill they're trained in. And that seems really kind of ridiculous. Like, it just kind of seems like they're throwing stuff at the problem, and they haven't really thought through the ramifications of what that's going to do. Because, as somebody pointed out, why would you do that? Because it makes ability scores not matter anymore. It allows people to min-max and not have any consequences.
Wait, is the plus 3 in addition to the ability score or in place of?
You get to choose whether you would use the ability score modifier or a flat plus 3.
Hmm.
So the example they have is in the playtest packet, the rogue has a wisdom of 8.
Yeah.
And perception and trap finding is linked to wisdom.
Right.
Which means someone with a high wisdom is going to have a better chance of detecting traps. Mm-hmm. And people said that's kind of dumb. So now Wizards said, oh, we'll give you a, if you're training the skill, the rogue can just use a plus 3 bonus.
Hmm.
Meaning you can use wisdom as your dump stat and not suffer any penalties.
Hmm. Oh, I wonder why they did that. It seems like it would be a lot easier with the whole background thing. It kind of gives you situational bonuses. Why not just kind of go with the traditional rogue bonuses, you know? Listen at doors, find traps, pickpockets, etc.
Well, they do have that already in that's part of the thief class package.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the comments on the article said, when I told my players about this, he said, great, all my characters will multiclass into thief because I'll always get to choose that plus 3 bonus when I use a skill I'm trained in.
Well, I saw that comment too, but there's no mention at all about multiclassing yet. There's no knowledge whether that'll work or not.
The danger is then they're going to have to make multiclassing really convoluted
mm-hmm.
to kind of prevent that. Probably one of my biggest disappointments between 3.5 and 4 was what they did the multiclassing. 3.5, I mean, nothing's perfect, but it was easy to understand.
Mm-hmm.
Everything just kind of adds together.
Yeah, whereas in 4, I mean, you didn't get everything, and yeah, it just seemed like a complete waste of time.
Yeah.
And of course, there was the dangers, like people took the one level of ranger and got these two-weapon fighting. So then they moved that to second level, and you're like, well, it's not super elegant,
yeah.
But I understand why you're doing it. Whereas here, it seemed like kind of a simple response is that, well, if so many of your skills are tied to wisdom, I guess you shouldn't make that 8.
Yeah.
You know, I guess you say, well, I'm guessing the rogue then needs to be somewhat good at perception and things like that, if they're supposed to spot stuff. Would you make your dexterity 8? No. Why is that? Oh, because it's tied to so many of the rogue skills.
Right.
Would you make a fighter's strength 10? No.
Yeah, I use kind of the same argument.
But they might be coming from a fourth edition logic where you have like a bard who could just throw everything into charisma, whether it made sense or not, because everything was tied to charisma.
Mm.
And then you might have like a secondary stat that needed to be somewhat decent because of certain triggers or bonuses. But other than that, you can just have an 18 charisma and that was
right.
It.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm going to reserve judgment on it because it doesn't make much sense to me why they would do that. It seems so easy that you could just add the bonuses of things that thieves are supposed to be good at, rogues are supposed to be good at, into the rogue class or into the various, what's it called, themes of it, where you get to decide what type of the class you are. But I don't see why they wouldn't do that. It seems like such a simple answer. There might be some other reasoning behind it. So I don't know. I prefer to see what's produced in the next packet before judging.
I'm pretty sure that the reason was pretty clear, because in the article, Mike Merles specifically said that so you can have a thief with a low wisdom who is still good at finding and removing traps.
But I still don't understand. Why don't you just add a plus 3 to finding and removing traps as part of the class?
They already have that.
So is then the difficulty levels off? I don't know. It doesn't make much sense to me why they did it. So I want to see kind of how the rule itself works rather than just a blog post.
Because the playtest is so open. And there's a lot of good with that, but there's a lot of bad, and that means like people are throwing out ideas in a hurry, and other people are quickly spotting and how they would abuse or break it. You see that in other games like Magic,
mm-hmm.
where they have to take back cards and things
yeah.
like that because people figured out the combos that would break the game.
Yeah,
I mean, look at their surprise rules that they had in the last the playtest, where they made it a penalty. Like a minus 20 to their initiative penalty.
Yeah.
But then I guess in the course of a playtest, they had two groups of goblins, and one was making a lot of noise, and one was doing the ambush, but because they made the surprise thing a penalty and not a bonus, it meant that both the loud group of goblins and the quiet group of goblins both benefited from the surprise.
Mm-hmm.
And they're saying that didn't make sense. And you're like, yeah, you're right. That doesn't make sense. But didn't that come up earlier?
Yeah.
You know, when in the playtest, no one thought to like kind of split the monsters and do something where, or even have two sets of monsters where there is a distraction.
I got to say, that was one of the things that I thought was kind of weird when I first saw the initial playtest packet. And that's before any of the blog posts or anything, that the surprise rules did look weird. I mean, here you've got this really cool idea about advantage and disadvantage, you know? Why not build that into the prize system, put one team at the advantage or the other at the disadvantage? But they got kind of this weird, arbitrary-looking minus 20 to initiative. It just didn't seem to be very smooth or make much sense. So yeah, I'm not surprised that that was one of the criticisms.
Yeah, and as you just said, and kind of as Lyle said before, like, a lot of stuff, like we said before, the fighter, hey, people are saying the fighter is boring. It's like, well, A, yeah, what did you expect? And B, why did none of this stuff come up in the internal playtesting you did and the friends and family round playtesting you did? Why is it only kind of coming up now? That seems kind of strange to me. It's like, didn't you playtest this stuff before, and didn't those issues come up before, and didn't you kind of deal with them already? And the fact that they haven't or didn't, and now you're coming up with fixes for them, just kind of makes it seem like you're throwing spaghetti at the wall and seeing what sticks.
Well, hey, it could be what you guys said, you know. Maybe Hasbro told them, you gotta, from the very get-go, you gotta put it out there and see what people are saying.
Yeah, it could be.
So in the other articles that came out talked about goblins. And there was a new poll about sort of exactly what the gnoll and the orc do, goblins, hobgoblins, and bugbears. Do they match your image of D&D goblins, hobgoblins, and bugbears? Sort of exactly the same thing we've seen before. But we also got a chance to see the poll results from the orc and gnoll polls. And the overwhelming vast majority said, yes, they look like D&D orcs and gnolls, which...
What a surprise! Should,
yeah, exactly. That should not have come as any surprise to anyone, you know? So...
You know, actually, this goblin article I think was better than the orc gnoll one, because the goblins have changed quite a bit, especially in their relations to each other throughout the various editions. So this one kind of has an excuse.
I guess. I kind of look at it like, hey, why don't... I think maybe this comes from trying to do a generic fantasy world, right? Come up with a strong theme for them. Come up with something interesting. You make up something and let people kind of, you know, decide whether it's cool or not, rather than just saying, here's your bog standard goblin. Do you like it?
Yeah.
You know? It's a goblin to you?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm totally ready. Feed me. Bring the spoon.
Yeah. I said the next D&D poll they're going to do is, does it look like a sword? Does it look like a sword to you? Does it look like a D&D sword?
Oh. Should we have two blades? No? We did discuss this, but we looked at previous editions and found that the two-blade sword was pretty rare, you know? So we really want to capture the spirit of old D&D.
The artist guy with a six-bladed sword.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, we found out not a lot of people liked Crawl with the three blades. And there's like a 40-year-old guy right now laughing on that one. Crawl! I think it was Crawl. No. Oh, maybe I made a mistake.
The 40-year-old guy was screaming at the speaker.
He's screaming
going,
at his computer. No!
He's lighting up the internet right now. Was it Crawl? Crawl had the you threw something thing. And I think it had the sword with the three blades, but it could have been another one of those 80s fantasy ones. And you were able to shoot all of the blades or two of the blades?
So it was a gun sword.
Yeah, I guess so.
Anyway, yeah.
But I'm pretty pleased that we're not going to see it. That gun sword in D&D next.
You never know. That could be the next poll. Do you want to see guns in D&D?
Yeah. At least that would be controversial.
Yeah,
it'd be different. Do we want to see this? Yeah. Do we want to see robots? I don't know. They should do an article and be like, oh, this is what we're thinking for a dragon, and just have like, you know, Mecha Godzilla or something. It's like, whoa! Lights it up. All right, we're listening. We've decided to do this red dragon.
People still vote a 3 out of 5.
Yeah, probably.
Love it. Hands should be smaller. And this brings us to our new series, RPG Rookies. And this series is going to be primarily for people who are new to role-playing games, both as game masters or as players. But for more experienced RPGers, there could be perhaps some advice that they didn't think of, or if they could let us know what we forgot and what they think would be valuable for somebody who's brand new to the hobby. And of course, we're introducing this series about 20 minutes into the episode, so I think people will get a good idea of what they can expect from the hobby. It's complaining about different editions, me talking about my body, And, I mean, these are staples of the hobby, really.
Grousing about rules that you don't like. Yeah. How you would do better and change them.
Yeah, obviously. Well, why lie? So obviously it's going to be a world of fun. And what we like to do is just, you know, try to make it a little bit easier because, unlike most hobbies, perhaps there's a higher learning curve. Well, actually, that doesn't make any sense. Is painting easy? Is martial arts easy? All right, just ignore that. Like most hobbies, there's a steep learning curve.
I was going to say there aren't many teachers for this kind of hobby.
Thank you, Wayne. Yeah. And I think in this hobby is we help each other. what we'll do is we're going to divide it into game masters and players. In this episode, we're going to focus on the things you should think about before the first session, before you even start playing. And in a future episode, we'll actually talk about things to think about while you're playing. So for the game master, and we'll start off with the game master. And for the game master, we'll be looking at, first off, where do you get your ideas? Like the story ideas. So, of course, this is for the rookies, so just to reinforce, the game master is the person who kind of thinks of the primary story. Of course, the players will contribute to the story, but their primary responsibility is kind of like the director and the writer of a movie.
Hmm. Yeah, I was going to say that, honestly, the best place to get ideas is from other media. And you just kind of, there's no problem with sort of blatantly stealing ideas from either novels, TV shows, movies, or published modules, which are kind of like prepackaged game stories to run during a session.
Yeah. That's easy to say, though, but like, how do you take these ideas? So should I just take Aaron Brockovich and then make that as a role-playing game?
You know what?
Whatever.
If that's what excites you and you can get players excited about it, go for it.
Yeah, whatever floats your boat, man.
But, I mean, because of the story, one big difference between a movie or a book is that as soon as, it's just like, what do they say, like military planning never survives contact with the enemy. And even though you're responsible for the story, it's not necessarily going to survive contact with the players.
Right, probably.
Because they're immediately going to contribute, and they have a lot of influence on that story. So what do you mean, like, what would you take away from other media to give you that first seed of a story?
Well, there's a lot of different aspects to media that you can use. You can use the story idea. For example, if there's a really cool villain or just the way that the plot unfolds is really interesting, you could try and mimic that into a story that you could fit new characters into. But again, like you said, with the caveat that the characters are definitely going to change that story along the way. But you can also take the theme of a movie. You can, if something is kind of dark and brooding and mysterious, you can try and work that into the game. And one way of doing that is taking the different kinds of settings and the elements and the feeling that's portrayed in the TV or movie and trying to put that and describe that to your players.
Can you give me an example where you've done that?
Wasn't with you guys, but one of the ones that worked well for me was the movie Dark City. Was that the name of it?
Yep. Yep.
That's with
Kiefer Sullivan?
Yes, that's the one, yeah. That one, and I used it for a cyberpunk campaign, but just kind of the way the main character is moving around the city and the everything is falling apart and dark, and when he turns around a corner and then turns back, the scenery behind the corner has changed ever so slightly. And yeah, it set up a really good foreboding kind of mood among characters.
I think that's pretty good. I was thinking, whenever I'm watching like a movie or reading a book, I often have like a what if moment, you know, because media like books and TV, they're not interactive. You can't change anything that you're watching or reading. Mm-hmm. But you just kind of wonder, okay, like what would happen if, to use the horrible new Clash of the Titans movie example, so what if Perseus decided to not fight, you know? Or what if the end of the movie was different? You know, what if the hero doesn't win? Or, you know, there's kind of these, I guess, media tropes, and you kind of wonder just what if. Or you kind of put yourself in the position of the protagonist, and you say, I would have done something different. Or to use an example that you came up with, Lyle, you said you read an anthology of vampire stories.
Yeah, it's going to be nice.
All right. Then we'll just jump in then.
When it came around to me, I was going to be good. Yeah. I don't take story ideas so much as I take scenes. And maybe similar to Chris is I take maybe elements. And yeah, this vampire anthology short story was a boxing match between two humans. But it was like, you know, with razor blade, gloves and things like that, and they were competing for the honor to see who would become a vampire, get changed into a vampire. And I thought it was I didn't particularly care for the story, but I really liked that part of the story. And I thought, what's that Mueller guy who's the winning boxer? What's his story? Like, what happened before? And what's going to happen after? Because in the course of the fight, his penis gets cut off. And one of the vampire jokes that it's like, oh, I don't, how happy do you think he's going to be, you know, living in eternity without his unit? I forget if he's unit or something. He was like some sort of slang word. And I just thought, yeah, what, how happy would that person be? And then just start to build the story around where this person becomes an important part of the story, but it's not a recognizable story, even though I've totally stolen this idea from some other property, but somebody can't go, oh, we're playing Aliens,
mm-hmm.
which was what was a problem I had in a role-playing game called Aliens, which is based off of the movie.
Well, gee, I think there's your problem right there.
And the flaw in that game is the flaw if you were trying to redo Aliens, is that people quickly figure out, oh, by the way, there's going to be aliens. So we were Colonial Marines, and they're like, oh, these people disappeared. We've lost contact with them, and the ship is coming back, and of course we're like, oh.
How about we just nuke it?
Yeah, we're like, oh, I bet you there's aliens on that ship. And we couldn't nuke it, so we just set up an ambush, you know, when the ship came in. Mm-hmm. And then the game master kind of looked at us and went, well, I guess we just won't continue this story.
That's right.
And we were actually trying to play along, but we were like, well, we know they're aliens because, you know, look at the cover of your book. Yeah. It says aliens.
Right there on your GM sheet, it says alien. Is that a chest burster over there on that panel? Yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, there is a problem with totally taking a story, especially a recognizable story, and building your story around that, your game around that, but taking elements and even taking different elements from different stories or different movies, and you create your own. And one advantage about another thing about taking the elements is that they don't necessarily have to link to a very hard linear story. So then the players can have a lot of creativity as well, and then they can shape the story.
Hmm.
Yeah. So like what Chris is saying about Dark City, I mean, things changing, and you look around, and you get maybe a feeling of paranoia, or you know, start to question your senses. That just adds to the player's enjoyment, and they can start adding to the story
mm-hmm.
and how they respond to that. They're not necessarily going to say, oh, we're doing Dark City. Oh, I know what we need to do now.
Yeah. I often like taking the premise from movies as well. Actually, what you were talking with Clash of the Titans, not the second one, but the first one. I had the idea of that where the gods required the prayers of the mortals in order to stay into power. So the gods were always warring over this. I thought that was a really cool idea that you could base a game off of, because that would be a way you could have the gods acting directly in a fantasy world, because they still needed the people to work with. So, yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say, in terms of sort of changing stuff or taking elements or finding things you want to change, pretty much all the games I've run recently have at least partially been inspired by published modules, because I think those are great resources. You don't have to run it whole cloth, and usually I don't, because usually I find something in the module that I want to change, or I think personally doesn't make sense, or I don't like. But I've cut up and rearranged pieces of published modules, and I think those are great places to start, because a lot of the work is already done for you. Instead of taking these elements from other media and then trying to build a story around it, a published module is going to already have some semblance of a story for you, and things that a beginning sort of game master would sort of have questions about, but then you don't have to run it exactly as it's written.
No, I think a publishing venture definitely has a lot of advantages for somebody new to game mastering. One is, professionals have made them up. And also professionals who know the whatever game you're playing. And if it's one of the introductory adventures, then it's a good introduction for you and for your players into that system, into that world. And it's generally designed to do that. And also, when you're running it, it allows you to focus less on the story and more on your craft, your game mastering skills.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Yeah. And sometimes you can get so focused on making your story interesting is that you forget rules, or you forget to read up on something that's going to be important in the next session, because you're so focused on what is that scene going to be.
Mm.
As opposed to, I need to know the rules for how they interact.
Yeah.
And also, a lot of them come with box text. And not everybody's a fan of box text, Wayne. But it's kind of built-in flavor, and you can use it as is directly with your players if you're not that comfortable with making up the flavor, or you can kind of use that as inspiration for yourself to try and set up the scene and the mood of the encounter.
Yeah, I like box text.
You brought it up before I did, but I was going to say, I think, actually, I like box text in the sort of the context of a beginning GM, because, as you just said, Lyle, having this block of text you can read that sets up scenes and the emotion and the tone of the game allows sort of the beginning GM to kind of sit back and not worry about having to do those things and to focus on perfecting their craft of just running the game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where they can say, okay, all I have to do is sort of know how to run the game, and when I get to this block of text, I can read it and set things up for the players.
Okay.
Hey, do we need to define block text, box text, for newbies?
Sure.
And just in case anyone doesn't know what we're talking about, box text is usually a small box of text, a paragraph or so, that kind of sets out the mood and describes the scene that you're entering. You enter a bar. It's dimly lit. There's corners everywhere with dark, shady characters in every corner, or something like that.
Yeah, it's the text that you should read out to the players.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes put it in a box. Hence the name, box text.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Now, so you've decided what your story is, or you've decided to run a particular published adventure, which is great. So the first thing you should do is think about what questions you want to ask yourself.
The first question I ask myself is, what kind of characters would fit this story? Because not every character fits every story. Like, if you're the game master and you've come up with an idea sort of like for a film noir sort of style game, you're not going to want a fantasy character in your game, right? I mean, that's an extreme example, but sometimes there can be a disconnect between the type of story that you're interested in telling and the characters that the players want to create.
Mm-hmm.
So it might seem a bit railroaded to some people, but the first question I ask myself is, what types of characters would fit for this story?
No, I mean, that's a good point. I mean, and to use something where an example where you can see confusion, let's say if you play a BattleTech game or a Star Wars game, some people might have like a very clear idea of what type of character they would want to play in that world. They might want to play in BattleTech a mech warrior, and in Star Wars they might want to play an X-Wing fighter pilot.
Mm.
But if you're not going to have any part of your game take place in space, or you're in BattleTech it's all about some political intrigue, or it actually does take place in space, then there's not much room for those type of characters. So.
Yeah, and I should point out that it should be sort of a dialogue between the players and the GM,
mm-hmm.
right? Because as the GM, you may have this great idea for a story you want to run. You talk to your players. Nobody's interested in playing the characters necessary for that game or the type of characters that would fit that game. Well, then you're going to have to change your game or adapt the elements so that kind of everybody at the table is happy.
That's actually what I wanted to say with that. My first question is less what do characters fit the story, but what characters do the players want to play?
So I guess that gets into the other point, which was what questions do you ask the players?
Mm-hmm.
So since we're kind of overlapping them, we'll just throw them both. There's two types of questions you want to ask. One, you would ask the players, and the questions that you would ask yourself.
I think you're selfish at pretty well.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Thanks, guys.
You're the man.
So. Yeah, I guess the question to ask would be, you kind of pitch the game
mm-hmm.
and say, would you guys be interested in playing it? I mean, it's as simple as that. I want to run this type of game. First, is that sound interesting to you? I mean, if you say, I want to run a game where everybody plays vampires and everybody hates vampires, then yeah, maybe that was a mistake. But asking the question, you find out, and it was like, can we do werewolves? And you're like, well, how much of my story could I make into werewolves,
Yeah.
And yeah, so that's definitely the first question is like, are you interested in this?
Mm-hmm.
And if it falls flat, well, what would you be interested in?
Right.
Yeah.
Did any of it sound interesting?
No? Ah. Right. Do you even want to play a role-playing game?
And
no.
Then, right. Like to run it yourself, jerk.
Yeah.
All right. So we're going to play hockey again tonight. Okay.
No, that's a good point.
Now, should I put the books in my hockey bag? No. Okay. I'll just leave them out then.
Probably goalpost, maybe.
Maybe I bring the books out in the bar later? No? No? Okay.
What's that? You'll call me the next time you play hockey? All right, great. 2 months later.
Another question to ask yourself as a game master is, how long do you want the game to go for? Like, and you think of it as sessions. I find doing one session is, it seems like it might take the pressure off, but it often seems too short. So a nice starter game or story, you look at maybe 2 to 3 sessions is pretty good. Yeah.
And for sessions,
it's not much of a commitment for the players, but it does give you enough time that if, you know, because you're new as a game master, and some scenes can run a little bit longer and longer than you plan. And if you only have like time for one session, it's like, well, that was it. And all we never really got out of this room. So, especially with when I ran Marvel Heroic Role Playing, I was new to the system and we were trying to test out the system. And yeah, we never got out of the hallway.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I think that was mostly due to crappy roles and crappy playing than anything.
Yeah.
But that's a good point, Wayne. I mean, that can happen too, you know. As we said, the best laid plans can definitely go to waste. Another question I ask myself when I'm building a game is, what's the opposition going to be? What's the conflict that the players are going to be up against? And usually that's the case of some kind of big, bad, evil guy. So I'll design up that character, and I find it really useful to design what their plan is, what they want to do, what they want to achieve, and how they would go about doing it if there was no intervention from the characters. But of course there will be, so the story has to adapt at that point. But yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good question, because, you know, a game with no conflict is going to be pretty boring.
Yes.
I'm sure I can attest to.
Yeah, I don't want to imply that it's an absolute necessity for it, but for me, I find that really gets my creative juices flowing. It's how I come up with the better stories, so it's what works for me.
You know, this might be getting a little advanced, but I think setting up that sort of that timeline of events that are going to happen, assuming that the player characters don't intervene, it takes the pressure off you as a GM, because you don't always have to be, or you don't always have to react to what the player characters will do. You know that certain events will happen at certain times, and you can not really sort of kick back, but you don't have to think of a lot of stuff on the fly, or as much stuff on the fly, because you will have to sort of improv. But having that schedule of things that are going to happen kind of allow you to react to what the players do.
It can be helpful to do a flowchart. I think you do that a lot, Wayne.
Yeah.
And in the flowchart, even if you have a publisher venture, it's a good way to just see if you really kind of understand the way the story is going, is to do like a little scene-by-scene guide. And you can do the flowchart, whether indicating if the players succeed in something, what would happen? If they ignore it, what would happen? And that could be a good reference point. And it make it very easy for you between the sessions, or even during the session, to just quickly reference that, and you'll know where to find the place in the published adventure, or where to start planning next, if you're doing your own story.
No, I'm glad you brought that up, because I didn't think of it, but I did exactly that for the pulp game that I ran. And yeah, it was just like a flowchart, scene by scene, and I just thought of, okay, what are sort of the most likely outcomes? I didn't think of all the possible outcomes, but just what are the most likely outcomes for these scenes? Maybe 2 or 3 options, and yeah, it was just a flowchart. Okay, if the players do X, then that'll lead to this scene, and if the players do Y, that'll lead to the scene over here. And yeah, just planning that out helps you get an idea for the flow of the session and the story. And of course, not everything's going to go as planned, but then it allows you, okay, great, they skip all these scenes, which means now we're over here on the flowchart, and you don't have to sort of, you're not lost into what you're going to do next, because you've sort of basically planned out what's going to happen. It's almost kind of like writing a movie, essentially, except that be prepared for it to change.
All right, another question I ask myself is, as a game master, would be, do I need props? Do I need, like, battle mats or little cardboard cutouts or miniatures?
That's a question I've never really asked myself before.
Well, I was thinking, like, if you're a beginner game master, is that going to help you, or is that a distraction?
Hmm.
So I'll say it can be a distraction, because it can be one more thing that you're worried about. It can add a lot to the game, but sometimes you're so worried about kind of the prop or the, you know, let's call it resource management that's on the table, that it's difficult for you to focus on what you know, your flow chart or your published adventure.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to agree with that, because, you know, I've done that before. I've worked for a long time on a prop, and then I said, you know what? I've wasted a lot of time on this prop. It doesn't really look all that great, and all that time could have been spent on making sure I have down what's going to happen in the story.
Yeah, I mean, we make use of things like colored beads to track health or things like that, or little tokens to signal that someone's doing something. And those are all good and helpful, but oftentimes you kind of got to know what the system is to begin with to know how these resources can help you manage the game. You know, I was thinking about this prior to this episode, and I would recommend that people try to go really minimal or minimalistic with these with your first game or so. And that way you can just really focus on the system, really focus on explaining things and talking to the player, especially if you're fairly new to the hobby and just that dynamic. I mean, we're so visually oriented. It's a little bit of a switch to get people to try to think. I mean, if people get confused, if you're describing where people are in a room, all you need is a piece of paper or like a dry erase board, and you just quickly draw a square and just quickly indicate where the people are.
I was going to say, let's cross over to play a little bit, but also I find that the more you put on the table, the more of a distraction it can be for the players, especially if you're new players and the GM is going to sort of be explaining the game. People may tune out or, you know, there's something new and interesting on the table. And it sounds very juvenile, but people fiddle with stuff when they get bored, and the less it's on the table, the less there's a chance for that to happen.
You know, one point you brought up there, Lyle, was about system. It's one thing, it's less a question to ask yourself, but more just a piece of advice, is that you got to know the system. You have to be ready. And imagine somebody giving a speech and then pausing for a minute to look down at their notes or look up something in a book. It takes you out of the moment and out of the story, so it's a very important thing.
That is good advice, but, I mean, you got a 400-page rule book, and you say to somebody, well, you got to know the system. So are we saying to somebody that you have to know 400 pages worth of rules in order to run a game? I mean, that's intimidating, and I think that's what keeps a lot of people away from playing, and especially a lot of people away from running a game because, yeah, they don't want to look like an idiot, because who has time to read 400 pages these days, you know?
Mm.
There's the internet.
Mm. There's that list you're working on. No, I was going to say, like,
I'm being very cryptic with this list. Everybody's like, what list?
No, I was going to say, I think all of us consider ourselves pretty established game masters, but...
I don't.
No, I'm crap.
All right. We have run games. How's that?
Okay.
But even now, like...
Established.
Established is the fact that you have done it before.
I've established it.
Anyway, the point I was going to make is...
I consider myself an incorporated game master.
I'll say that. How about this? I would bet that even people who have run games before still get nervous before they run a game because they don't want to forget a rule or look like an idiot or look silly, as you said, Lyle.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing to remember, and it's a pretty difficult thing to remember, is that you as the game master, if you forget something, just make something up, honestly. Sort of just keep the story going.
Most games have a core mechanic that's can be summarized in one rule. For example, D&D, I guess you could say it's a D20, and you got to roll over a certain number. And a lot of them are like that. You have to roll over a certain number. If you look at World of Darkness and all of its games, it's you need to roll a 7 on a D10, and then if you get at least one success, then that you're successful.
Yeah,
and you just got to match the number of dice you roll with the number of dots. And if you can remember that one core rule and know that cold, then you can get by in most situations. Of course, there's a lot of other rules that supplement that and are variations of that one core rule within the book and dealing with different situations and explaining them very helpfully to you. But yeah, sometimes instead of just, you know, spending 5 minutes looking through the rule book, just take that core rule and work with that. And so it's like somebody says, well, I'm going to use a bazooka to hit him. And you're like, well, I don't really know what we would do with a bazooka. But all right, just use the core rule and look at the numbers that are attached to the bazooka and do what makes sense.
Yeah.
Or since it's a bazooka, just let the bad guy explode.
Yeah. Awesome. And he's dead. He's dead, yeah.
It's a bazooka. He's dead. What did you expect?
Yeah, let the player roll some dice so they feel like they've done something, and they go, and it blows up.
Yeah, that's actually a really good piece of advice, Lyle. Like, I think every time I've ever played a game and a grappling situation has come up, we've had to look it up in the book. no matter how long I've played.
Yeah, just like, roll a d20, whatever it is. Yeah, you grapple him.
You win, whatever.
He's down.
All right, it's going to be my d20 versus your d20. Are we going to do strength or whatever? Just roll the dice. Just roll the dice.
Honestly, that's all the rules really are. And I think most games now, even in the past, at the beginning of the book, or beginning of the PDF, whatever, it'll say, these rules are guidelines. If you find something you don't like or you find something you don't understand, change it.
Yeah.
And that rule's always there, but it's always, I think, the one we forget the most as game masters, because you kind of want to be fair and you want to use the rules as they're written, but it just sometimes just make stuff up and use that one kind of core mechanic to resolve whatever comes up rather than spending time trying to find the exact rule during the session.
And if a player gives you a hard time, then forget to tell that player when the next session is.
Exactly.
We'll call you in 2 weeks.
Or I was going to say, just say, you know what? Your character, you know that bazooka you fired? You get caught in the blast too, you're dead. See you later.
All right. Well, let's move on to the player. So the player is very similar. First up, where do you get your character ideas from?
It's one of the places I sort of get character ideas from is reading the game, the system book. There'll either be something in the book, either like a piece of fluff or sometimes a mechanic that seems really interesting that I'll then kind of ask myself that what if question and play around with that and come up with an idea for a character.
Actually, me too. It's kind of a nerdy answer, but I like to build characters around the mechanics, like look at the different kind of numbers that can be plugged into a system and work and see what kind of angle I can come at the system, and oftentimes a character will bloom out of that.
Oh, okay. That's not what I do, but...
Enlighten us!
No, I'd probably do a more standard approach of, you see something cool in a movie, and you're like, oh, that'd be neat to play a character like that, and then you look at... I find it helpful to understand the system as a player, is to kind of come at it with that idea, you know, like, I want to play this guy. Can I make this guy in this system? You know, so if you're reading like a Game of Thrones or something like that, I want to play the Hound. Hmm. How do I make the Hound in D&D? How do I make the Hound in World of Darkness? Yeah.
Hmm. I mean, just like different side of the coin.
Yeah. Yeah. I find it can be quite intimidating to like go from the rules because you don't really understand what the rules are. But if you kind of have an idea of the type of character you want to be, even if you're taking like, yeah, just like Batman. I want to be Batman. And then you're like, well, he's really smart and he's really fast. What these attributes or whatever they call them or these skills match up with my concept of this character?
Yeah, that's true. I was thinking it wouldn't even have to be like a mechanic. Like, for example, reading through the World of Darkness book, right? They list all the skills. And I mean, the skills aren't like different from what you'd see in other books, but sometimes just like reading a skill description of what that skill does, you said, wow, that's an interesting skill. What kind of character, what kind of person would have that skill? I want to try playing that character.
Yeah, do that a lot too. If I find some mechanic somewhere that looks interesting, I'll build a character around it. I remember for 4th edition D&D, there was a feat that allowed you to throw regular melee weapons. So I used that to build like a dwarf that his entire thing was throwing axes around. So he carried 10 axes on his back. He wasn't very fast.
So what questions should a player ask themselves, and what player question should a player ask their game master?
So I guess question to ask yourself, what do I want to do with this character? Is there like a goal this character is working towards? Is there some kind of motivating factor that's going to come out during the game?
I was thinking, it's summertime. Do I want to spend my summer indoors?
All right,
smart guy. I joke.
No, that's actually a very good point, Wayne. It's good to build goals and motivations for your character. Then you'll know what to do with them. It's kind of like building a plan as a GM, as we mentioned before, but kind of as a player, that way you'll know how to react to different situations.
After playing for a while, I started out by writing like a big backstory for most of my characters. I could essentially get a feel for what the character was.
Huge backstory.
Yeah, but then after playing, I found, you know, playing for a while, especially with you guys, I found out that's not always a good thing to do because I found a lot of the stuff I didn't use. So I'm starting to come around to sort of your way of thinking, Lyle, where you have to sort of play the character for a session or two before you really understand who they are. But I think you still should at least have some kind of goal or something you want to do with the character so you don't just kind of stand around doing nothing as a player.
Yeah, I think of it more as like, what is the concept I want to do? Like, if you say, well, I'm going to be a fighter, or I'm going to be a pilot, So what kind of pilot? And if it helps to go, you know, like think of iconic pilots, then yeah, sure, do that. But then I think then I would switch to the question I would ask the game master, and how does this character fit into your story? Or how could it fit into your story? And then go from there. Because a lot of times you get more ideas in that back and forth. And also, I know we said what questions would you ask the game master, but what questions you could ask the other players is let them know what your character concept is. And if you're playing a computer hacker and everybody would be colossally bored with you being a computer hacker, then yeah, think of how to make that more interesting. Or you find out that somebody else is a concept and how can you work together. And sometimes it's even really helpful to kind of pair up the characters or give them some kind of common backstory.
When you mentioned sort of the pilot, another good question to ask is,
is there going to be spaceships in this game? No? Oh.
Yeah. Question to ask, is my character a spaceship? No, all right. No, I was thinking, even if you choose sort of like a concept or an iconic sort of pre-existing character to base your character on, I would ask, how is my character sort of different from the norm? Or how is my character different from what people would expect him to be?
Or also, how is my character different from the other players' characters? So that would, you're all bringing something to the table.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And also a good thing to ask to the game master is, what do I need to put into this character? What's this game going to be about? And if you build an entirely social character for a pulp game, it's not going to fit that well, so.
Well, I'd say if you build an entirely social character for a pulp game that's going to be all about traveling the world and fighting dinosaurs, well, then maybe no.
I knew Wayne was going to contest you as soon as he said that. I was like, oh, Chris, you're so nice.
You stepped in that one.
You're so young. So I guess the big thing there is, the big piece of advice in this episode is, just talk to each other.
Yeah, don't build stuff in a vacuum.
Communication is the key.
All right, and just reiterate what everybody says around you and use different words. I guess the sum up is like, yeah, there's a lot of rules, but there's one core rule. Know that. There's a lot of assistants out there like Pip Publish Adventures. Use those. And yeah, don't be afraid to be to shamelessly steal. Yeah. Okay, well, this ends the first installment of RPG Rookies, and we'll be revisiting this from time to time and offering some pretty basic but hopefully valuable advice for people that are thinking of getting into the hobby or people who are making a transition from player to game master. Yeah, and of course, if we miss some pretty basic advice that you think is pretty essential, just let us know, and we'll be sure to bring it up. Yeah, and we may give you credit.
Maybe.
You know, over the week, I had a thought.
So that thought that was on the forums. All right, well, thank you for joining us again on Out of Red Hands. Check us out online, www.idleredhands.com, outofredhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there on the website or stream it through iTunes, download it from DriveThruRPG or on Stitcher. You can talk to us by sending us an email, going through our forums, watching us on Twitter or on Facebook, or, it's just sending us an email, which I already said, but we like it so much that I said it twice. Yeah, that's it. And see you next time.
Bye.
I guess we're the Duran Duran of podcasts. All right, bye.
Drive Through RPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. Drive Through RPG. The one true source for RPGs. Road.
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.